This is Night Call, nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight, has psychiatry failed? With guest research center head at the Rockland State Mental Hospital, Dr. Nathan Klein. Night Call is an open forum. Speak for yourself. Ask your own questions. Call Night Call Collect from anywhere in North America. From the East and Midwest, call 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. And now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. Is mental illness like every other disease? Is it one that gets worse and neglected? Well, that just fits into the category of mentally ill, emotionally disturbed, or having psychiatric disorders. Or I should say, just who fits into the category? Well, many of us have seen some new group therapy sessions where people who seemingly can't relate to one another go through intense confrontations, emotional outbursts, and so on. But what is causing all this? Well, we know many, many people who have severe problems, who cannot relate, who are depressed, and so on. But just when is it that the person is supposed to seek a psychiatrist's help? When does this happen? And when does he need a physician's treatment? And when do you call a psychologist in? Well, these are some of the great personal problems that we hope to discuss with our guest tonight, Dr. Nathan Klein. He's the head of the Research Center at Rockland State Hospital in Orangeburg, New York. And he's a pioneer in the use of drugs for the treatment of mental disorders. Now, Dr. Klein has played a major role in the promotion of acceptance for the idea that mental patients are suffering from illnesses that should be understood and treated in a manner similar to physical ailments. So we welcome our guest tonight, Dr. Klein. Dr. Klein, thank you for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
Doctor, we'll begin our Night Call conversation by asking first, what causes mental illness? Are there several causes? Is it on the increase? And if so, why?
Well, before I even give you the answer to that, I wanted to put in a disclaimer. After 11 o'clock at night, I stopped working for the state, so that the answers I give are not official answers in terms of anyone except myself. With that as an opener, let me go ahead and try to answer your first question.
Thank you, Doctor.
I think basically that there are two causes of mental illness. One is something organic, which can be anything from as severe as a brain tumor to something much more subtle, too much alcohol. Probably one of the most interesting classical examples is from Alice in Wonderland, of all places. And if you'll recall, the Mad Hatter in Alice, in England at that time, there were people who made hats, and in preparing the felt, they had to use mercury. And many of them, as a result of this, did develop a type of organic illness, so that they did become mad, and the expression mad as a hatter was an evidence of one type of disorder, namely that caused by organic illness, whether it's something from within or without. The other type, I think, results from interpersonal conflicts, either between an individual and others on a psychological level, or sometimes as a result of conflicting emotions, drives, and needs within himself.
When we look at psychiatry today, or the field of psychiatry, we find that we don't look at it as something that's distant, or perhaps as some years ago when people needed psychiatric help, we kind of thought of it as a rich man's luxury. It seems that psychiatry has become a very meaningful part of our lives today. Does this mean that we have to, as laymen, do we have to learn more about what psychiatry can do or cannot do for us?
Well, I think one of the important things about it is the recognition that many conditions and disorders that formerly were thought to be the result of either perverse behavior or sheer irritation or weakness of one kind or another are now being recognized for what they are, namely a type of emotional disorder, so that definition of what constitutes psychiatric disorders. The other thing, of course, is that there's a kind of Parkinson's law almost, that patients appear as the treatment does. And now that there are much more treatment possibilities available, we are able to not only recognize these disorders, but treat them much more freely than was ever possible in the past.
Is analysis still important?
Oh, very definitely. The there are certain types of disorders that are treatable really only by intense psychotherapy, whether it's of the analytic type or some other. There are other disorders that which all the analysts from the time of Joan of Arc to the present wouldn't do any good, but a few milligrams of the appropriate chemical will cause relief of the condition. It's a question really of recognizing which disorders should be treated in which manner.
Of late, group therapy seems to be getting very popular. Why is this?
Well, I think that currently there is much greater recognition of both the rights and responsibilities and the importance of individuals. This is something that I think has been a trend through history, that at one time the tribe or the group was the primary focus of behavior. There's still a strong trend toward nationalism as the important focus, but in a country such as ours, the importance of the individual is continually emerging. This is part of the Western tradition that the individual is an extremely important person, and hence in therapy, there's a great deal of focusing, even though it's in groups, the focus is on how an individual relates to the group.
Dr. Klein, how do you respond to the various tests that are being given by companies and corporations for new employees? Is this a very important thing?
Well, you've hit on a subject which can be viewed from a great number of points of view. For one, I don't think that a lot of these are as, in quotation marks, scientific as they're purported to be. What they really are the extension of interviewing techniques. They sometimes pick out areas in which an individual is particularly good or not particularly good. They're useful in possibly determining suitable employment. On the other hand, there's a whole other angle to them as to whether they constitute an invasion of privacy. Certainly, I think that psychological testing of this sort, one, it certainly should be done by qualified individuals, and two, I think that the person's permission, either explicitly or by consent of taking the test, is involved. So that it's a question of whether you're viewing it from the question of how effective or useful the test is, or also the question of whether constitutes an invasion of privacy.
You view them as useful depending upon the person who is submitting the test.
Well,
or who's giving the test, I should say.
Yeah, and also what is the purpose of the test? I presume if someone were looking for a job as a salesman, that many of these tests would be able to pick up whether he has some of the potentialities for a good salesman, or whether he'd be better off doing work as an accountant by himself. They give some general leads as to the areas, although, of course, there are always exceptions. But I don't think that they're as completely scientific as some people at times pretend they are. They're useful, but I don't think much more useful, or sometimes as useful as a personal interview is.
When does a man decide that he needs to go to a psychiatrist?
That, I don't think it's so difficult to answer. I think that there are two criteria of whether someone is in need of psychiatric help. One is that their productivity is being seriously interfered with, either very seriously for a short period of time, or to a lesser degree over a long period of time. If they're not able to do whatever it is that they're accustomed to doing, whether it's being a housewife or a physician or a musician or whatever it is, if they find by reason of certain symptoms they can't perform as they normally do, that's one good reason for seeking help. The other is a fairly obvious reason that if someone is in pain, and certainly depression or anxiety is about as painful as any emotion can be, and probably in many respects more causes more anguish than physical pain does. So either of those two reasons, I think, are grounds for seeking help.
How young can a child be before he, if there's a need that he should go to a psychiatrist?
Oh, there, it's possible to recognize certain types of what one might put under the general classification of psychiatric disorders almost at birth. There's even one condition which is now pretty routinely tested for, something called phenylketonuria, a rather curious kind of disease, which they can test literally they test the child's diaper and look for in the urine. If it is not corrected, the individual grows up, with very few exceptions, to be mentally deficient. And what makes it such an interesting, peculiar kind of disease is that the way you treat it is that you eliminate a particular protein from the diet. What happens is that in these individuals, the body is unable to handle a particular protein, and if the child takes it, it literally develops mental deficiency. If this is eliminated from the diet, this particular protein, then the child grows up to be perfectly normal. So that really it begins at birth, and I'm sure that if we were able to test back even farther, which I think someday we'll be able to, we may be able to detect and correct certain disorders while the child is still in the uterus, still growing.
There are some people who look upon psychiatry as kind of a vogue. There are some people who have undergone analysis or some kind of therapy, and you meet them at parties or at social gatherings, and they'll tell you they've undergone 300 hours or 400 hours. What is the reason for this kind of attitude?
Well, there are, I thought you were up in a plane 300 hours of a solo flight or something. there are vogues in this sort of thing, but certainly it's an expensive, it's more expensive even than taking airplane lessons. In certain circles, it is an in thing to do, but by and large, I think most people who go to psychiatrists really need to go. During the war, we ran into the Second World War, something of the sort. We had people who tried to cop out of service by pretending to be mentally ill, and the great irony of it is that most of them who pretended to be actually were, because they did not fit into, did not accept the values, the framework of their own contemporaries, and as a result, they were highly suspect to begin with. So that I would say, by and large, a lot of people who say that they're going to a psychiatrist merely because it's the thing to do are actually in need of the treatment to begin with. So I think this is actually more exaggerated than is the case, that it's done simply as a an in thing to do.
But among poorer people, there seems to be a stigma attached to the idea that they may be involved with the psychiatrist or undergoing psychiatric help. But yet in the more affluent classes, that stigma does not seem to carry over.
Well, I think this is primarily a matter, frankly, of education. And one of the major reasons that I'm talking to you right now is to attempt to better to spread the gospel, so to speak, or clarify what the facts really are. I think there probably was a great confusion between cause and effect, which often happens. And people who were mentally ill sometimes behaved in a rather peculiar fashion, some of the behavior looked to be what one might call immoral or weak. There are people who were unable to complete the jobs that they started to do. Often, even whether they were adolescent or older, they would have peculiar sexual habits, everything from exposing themselves, masturbation, so forth and so on. And as a result, people got cause and effect mixed up sometimes, and they said, aha, he's mentally ill because he masturbated, or because he's weak-willed, or because of X, Y, or Z, when in point of fact, it was the illness which caused the this kind of behavior, with the recognition that people don't want to be ill, and the kind of nonsense where if someone is depressed and unable to do something, the relatives shake them and say, pull yourself together and, you know, look at all the people who are worse off than you are, which of course does absolutely no good, because the patient's already aware of this, and if it was a matter of voluntarily doing something, no one would want to suffer this way. So that I think that part of the thing is to recognize that people whose behavior or feelings or thoughts are deviant usually are people who are ill and are that way because of an illness and not because of some weakness or moral misbehavior, and they're in need of treatment.
Dr. Klein, when I ask you to hold, we'll come right back following station identification and we'll begin accepting calls from our Night Call listeners. This is Night Call in New York. Tonight, our conversation with Dr. Nathan Klein, has psychiatry failed? And Dr. Klein is the director of research at the Rockland State Mental Hospital here in New York. We'll return following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Dr. Nathan Klein after station identification. America is growing smaller. Speed of communication, speed of travel, and a worldwide revolution in human rights. These things bind us together into a common destiny. One man's problem is every man's problem. More and more we realize the only real problem is the human problem. People who need jobs, better educations, better places to live, better medical care, and better hope for the future. A chance to become a part of the American dream of freedom and opportunity. But for the American dream to succeed, each of us must be responsive to the needs of others, to give a damn about our brother or our sister, black or white. You'll find some answers to how you can give a damn, how you can offer your help, in a new booklet called Whose Crisis? Yours. You can get a copy without charge by writing to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, P-O-M-O-N-A, New York. Speak for yourself from anywhere in North America to guest psychiatric researcher Dr. Nathan Klein about new forms of psychiatric medicine. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And Dr. Meehan is calling in from Indianapolis, Indiana. He's hearing Night Call over WTLC. Dr. Meehan?
Doc? Yes?
Good evening, sir.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Your question, sir?
Dr. Klein, I'm a research psychologist, and I listen quite carefully to your thoughts about what sort of treatment the various types of disorders needed. And I agree with it 100%. I was wondering, what are your views on the relative advantages of short-term therapy with the behavior modification techniques?
Again, it's a matter of specific cases. The, in principle, behavior therapy, which probably is an intensification of life experience, kind of boiled down, depends on the individual case. I don't think that there is any one treatment that is universally applicable. It's a matter of selecting the appropriate treatment for the appropriate case, so that there certainly are occasions when behavior therapy is be best expressed by Mr. Tennyson when he says, God fulfills himself in many ways, lest one good custom should corrupt the world. And the difficulty is that someone comes along with a new type of therapy or a new approach and then attempts to treat everything and everyone with it. So it's really a matter of finding the appropriate treatment for the appropriate patient.
Yeah, specifically, what I was referring to is the really what I consider the relative inefficiency of psychoanalysis. In other words, it's a relatively long-term sort of therapy, and we have only X number of therapists, and three times X number of patients.
Well, it's even the proportions much worse than that.
Well,
there are in the United States about, at a maximum, 15,000 psychiatrists and probably roughly the same number of psychologists or sociologists or other therapists qualified in one way or another. And the estimates, conservative estimates, are from most of the studies have been done that roughly 25% of the population needs some kind of treatment in one form or another, which roughly breaks down to about 25,000 patients for each therapist, so that certainly one couldn't attempt or even think of attempting intensive psychotherapy for all of them. On the other hand, there are a relatively small number of patients who probably are in, for whom psychoanalysis is the treatment of choice. Again, there are other techniques, as you're well aware, ranging from group therapy to in other types of individual therapy to pharmacotherapy, namely drugs, behavior therapy. There are a whole variety. Sometimes even changing the lifestyle of an individual is extremely useful.
Well, that was my basic question. I thought it might be...
That's a good question.
I'd like to clarify for the audience if we talk in terms of there are various types of therapy, but many of them are short-term.
Yeah, well, obviously, that, as with any medical disorder, for that matter, if one can use a short-term treatment, it's less expensive and less time-consuming. It's obviously foolish to use a longer one, but again, it's a question of the ability to select the appropriate patient, which isn't always done, as I'm sure you're well aware.
Yeah.
Well, does this mean, doctors, that when a patient comes in or visits with his psychiatrist, that he can shop as he does in the supermarket and decide that he may want a 3-month a test or a 4-month or 5-month?
No, I think really basically what it is I happen to be in my office now at the end of a fairly good day's work of seeing patients. What it means is that one or two patients who came in today, we told them they had the right idea, but the right church, but the wrong pew, and that the kind of therapy which we offered was really not what they needed, and we referred them on to someone doing psychotherapy, since our stress is on short-term pharmacological drug treatment. On the other hand, we had two or three patients who were referred in today by people doing intensive psychotherapy who recognized the fact that in this particular case it would be very helpful to have, in addition to the psychotherapy, the addition of medication, so that when the patient comes in, it's the responsibility of the therapist to determine what is the best treatment for them. And I think there's much more tendency today to recognize that if you can't treat a patient, that it's frustrating to not only the patient but to you, so that there's, I think, an increasing tendency to recognize that there are a variety of therapies, variety of kinds of treatment, and to see that the patient is referred for the treatment which is best for him.
Dr. Meehan, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Out to Savannah, Georgia, Mr. Hales is hearing Night Call over WSOK. Mr. Hales?
Hello, doctor?
Yes.
I heard someone said, a few minutes ago, when do a man know that he's supposed to, see a psychiatrist?
Right.
And, if a man's mind is gone, really gone, how do you know, is he retarded or not?
Well, if someone is as far gone as you point out, then usually he's causing a nuisance to other people, his family, or to society, and someone in that case usually makes up his mind for him, really. He gets into trouble with the law or with a neighbor, the important thing is for people who have to deal with other people, whether they're teachers or policemen or firemen or what have you, is to also recognize that when someone is behaving in a particular way, that it may constitute a form of illness. Instead of throwing them into jail or getting into a fight with them, that to recognize that they're in need of treatment and see that they receive it. Now, there's a big effort on behalf of by the National Institutes of Mental Health, by the federal government, to set up pretty much all over the country community mental health centers. And one of the things that they are attempting to do is to educate all of us in what constitutes mental illness and to know how to handle it, so that someone who is as far gone as you indicate, if someone recognizes it, eventually I think they'd be able to call the local community mental health center and have someone from there inquire, you know, to help the man rather than to allow him to get into trouble.
Yes. Could you tell me, if they get a person like that, and what kind of treatment, they gave him?
Well, the first thing, if the man were dangerous to himself or others, which means that if he were had the idea that someone was trying to harm him and he was going to get them out of the way, he might be potentially dangerous to someone else, and sometimes these patients are suicidal. So step number one would be to make sure that he couldn't harm himself or others. And
like putting him in a,
It would mean putting him in now. Many cases, you don't even have to put him in a mental hospital. The most general hospitals today are equipped to handle patients of this sort for a day or two. There are now medications which, in probably 80 or 90% of the cases, within a matter of an hour or two, would get someone calmed down so that they no longer constituted a danger. Very often, these things can be brought on by all sorts of conditions. It may clear up even within a day or two. So the old idea that if someone went to a psychiatric ward or a mental hospital, they'd never get out again is totally changed. In fact, the mental hospital population of the country up until about 1956 was increasing 10 to 12,000 patients each year. But since the introduction of the drugs, the figures have just turned around, and today there are about 130,000, 140,000 less patients in in hospitals than there were in 1956.
Doctor, have not the psychiatrists been accused by many courts or many members of the court that there are too many mentally disturbed people who have been discharged from hospitals too early or before they had received effective treatment?
No. What happens, of course, is that, and it always has been that way, if someone gets involved in trouble, if he's been in a mental hospital, this is the first thing that's mentioned, that he's a former psychiatric patient. The current figures, by the way, are that roughly 1 out of 10 persons in the United States spends part of his life as a patient in a mental hospital, so that there are an awful lot of such people. But there have been a number of studies done, and they found that actually the rate of crime and particularly rate of violence among former psychiatric patients is lower than it is for the general population, so that it's merely that such individuals, that it gets mentioned. Whereas if they don't put in this patient never was a patient in a hospital, so that but by and large those who've been returned to the community have been able to maintain themselves quite adequately. This, of course, is again what the community mental health centers are aiming toward, and I think it's quite important that there to help the patient adjust even after he leaves the hospital, or really to prevent him from needing to go into the hospital.
Mr. Hales, thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. Our guest tonight is Dr. Nathan Klein. We'll return following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Dr. Nathan Klein after station identification.
What does it mean to awake in the morning and find that there's nothing to do? And what does it mean to be searching for something new? And what does it mean when you're...
What did you drop into when you dropped out of school? No job? No job skill? No money? If you're between 16 and 22, Job Corps can give you a chance. A chance to learn a skill. A chance to get a job. A chance to stop running. A chance to make some money. A chance to be somebody. Give yourself a chance. Call your local state employment office or write Job Corps, Washington, D.C., 20506.
Speak for yourself from anywhere in North America to guest psychiatric researcher Dr. Nathan Klein about new forms of psychiatric medicine. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
Dr. Klein, can psychiatry explain all human behavior?
No, I'm afraid not. We have enough trouble trying to explain deviant behavior. I think this is part of an exaggeration on what people expect of a psychiatrist. Actually, our job is to deal with people who have certain kinds of mental illness and do our best to get them back into the normal pattern. But certainly at this stage in our field, we can't explain all behavior.
Well, if it's possible to address yourself to that behavior that is not, and I don't know if this is the proper medical term, but that behavior that is not normal, would this not mean that there has to be some guideline?
You mean compared with what you would call normal behavior?
Right.
Yeah, but I think most of us, even without psychiatric training, recognize when someone's behavior is deviant or peculiar or eccentric. And you really don't have to be anything more than a reasonably sensitive, observant human, in most cases, to pick up that there's something going on wrong with someone else. And particularly if people talk freely to you and tell you how they feel, and they themselves often recognize that there's something wrong. But this doesn't mean you can explain all kinds of behavior. A lot of it we know how to treat, but we don't know what the cause is. But medicine, by the way, in general works this way. It sounds odd, but usually we find the cure, and after we found the cure, then we find what the disease is that we're treating. But medicine has always done this.
Well, speaking of medicine, people generally have a tendency to become kind of liberal in giving away medicines that perhaps has been prescribed for them. What is your feeling about that?
Well, that's one I feel very strongly about. I think that very often, first of all, patients, if they're doing well on some medication, they have a friend who has some complaint which they think is like theirs, will very generously offer to give them some of their medication, and sometimes they're foolish enough to take it. They say that the physician who treats himself has a fool for a patient, and the person who allows someone who's not a physician to prescribe for them is also getting into trouble. Along the same line, by the way, I think more people get into trouble not taking medication that doctors prescribe than by taking more than the doctor prescribed, because very often the patient feels that if he takes less medication that somehow or other he's improved, but he usually what he's doing is interfering with the successful treatment, so that the whole purpose in going to a physician, particularly if it's for a matter of medication, is to take advantage of his education and experience, so that the thing really to do is have confidence in what the doctor tells you to do. If not, then don't change the medication, but change the doctor.
Mr. Wright is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM in New York. Mr. Wright?
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
I'd like to speak to Dr. Klein.
He's on the line, sir.
Dr. Klein, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. The first one being that if it's agreed amongst qualified persons that the general populace of America is in need of some kind of psychiatric help, are these persons found in ghetto areas or impoverished areas, or are they roughly dispersed amongst throughout the nation in a sort of an equal percentage or ratio?
It's a very interesting question, because you come out with a peculiar answer. First, let me make a wider point. I do a fair amount of work setting up psychiatric services for foreign governments and seeing psychiatric disorders in other parts of the world. In general, the frequency and, in large part, the types of mental illness are the same, whether it's in Sarawak in North Borneo, or in Kuwait, or in Peru, or in New York. So that overall, the types of illness are pretty much the same. Your question about the poverty area is an odd one, because what happens is, frequently, if someone is mentally ill, they're unable to hold a job, and if they don't get treatment, they tend to drift into a poverty area. So that someone coming in from the outside, in fact, there was one famous study done in Chicago showing that the incidence of psychiatric disorders from what was called the island, a slum area in Chicago, was considerably higher than it was from elsewhere. But when they went back and found out where people had lived a year before, 2 years before, then it kind of leveled out. So that I don't think that slums are the cause of psychiatric disorder. I think that certainly any kind of stress makes life more difficult. But I think even if you got rid of all the slums and put everyone in a $50,000 house and gave them a good job, you'd still have pretty much the same pattern of mental illness as we presently have. I think it's a myth that psychiatric disorders are caused by slums and poverty.
No, what I was asking you, sir, was I wasn't saying that slums and poverty cause the mental illness. What I wanted to know was whether or not these persons, or a person suffering from mental problems, whether or not they were concentrated in these areas as opposed to areas in general in the nation. And if so, do you feel that this is inherent in the socialization process of America itself, or in the culture of America? Does the culture of America drive people insane?
No, I think that again, there would be a concentration of such people in the area, but largely because they were unable to get along adequately in other areas. Some people have the illusion, because of the high pressure and the nature of American society, that there's likely to be more illness than there is in, let's say, a nice, calm, rural society. I've done a fair amount of work in West Africa, for instance, and actually what isn't realized is what looks like a nice country, rural, idyllic existence is anything but, because people there are, for instance, afraid of the spirits of their, they don't properly pay tribute to their ancestors, the spirits of the ancestors will punish them if they cross a stream at the wrong place, or accidentally hit a tree that's taboo, the spirits that inhabit that, people feel may punish them, or someone may attempt to bewitch them or cast a spell on them, so that the life of people in places like West Africa or Southeast Asia is really pretty terrifying, because there are all kinds of threats and forces at work that we don't have here. We have the Internal Revenue Service after us, or the policemen if you cross the street at the wrong place. But by and large, we know pretty much, or think we know, what the causes of possible anxiety are, so that in many ways our culture is less stressful than some of the ones that look to be peaceful from our point of view.
Well,
Mr. Wright, thank you for calling, sir. I have a number of calls on the line, sir, and I want to try to get as many people in as I can. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
This time out to Kansas City, Missouri, Mrs. Hildreth is hearing Night Call over KPRS. Mrs. Hildreth?
Hello.
Good evening.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I wanted to ask Dr. Klein first how he felt about the relationship of the psychiatrist to clinical psychologist. I know that a very serious mental problem should be handled by a psychiatrist, but do you feel, Dr. Klein, that maybe some of the borderline cases could be handled by clinical psychologists?
Oh, yeah, I certainly feel that if the patient is in need of psychotherapy, that there is no worldly reason that a competent clinical psychologist couldn't handle it. Again, the only question I would have really would be to make certain that the diagnosis was one which did not call for some physical method of treatment, whether it's drugs or something else, so that we need all the psychiatric help we can get, whether it's been by clinical psychologist or psychiatrist or others. It's, again, a case of making certain that the patient is referred for the appropriate treatment, and once that's been determined, then I don't think if a clinical psychologist is competent to do it, why, fine.
Uh-huh. And also, we've been reading a lot about the new methods that psychiatrists are using. What do you think about group therapy?
Again, there are some people who actually respond better in group therapy. Their problem is not so much relating to, let's say, the psychotherapist, but relating to others of the same age or background, so that for certain patients, there's no question that group therapy is not only as good but superior to individual therapy. But, of course, there are also a great number of patients for whom individual therapy is more important, so that it really devolves down into the competence of the person making the diagnosis and deciding what treatment ought to be used.
Mrs. Elder, thank you for calling, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you. Out to Wisconsin, Mr. Hoffman is hearing Night Call over WTMJ. Mr. Hoffman?
Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening.
Dr. Klein, I admire your program and I wished it could be longer. I recall one thing that you mentioned tonight as far as in the mental capacity. For instance, you mentioned during World War II, if I recall, there were classes CPS, is that right?
Pardon?
I say, you mentioned that World War II we had mental problems and fellows, you know, that shirked and that.
Right.
And there were classes CPS, is that right?
I don't know, CPS.
Did you have any affiliations by chance with any of the mental hospitals overseas?
No, I was in the Public Health Service and assigned to the Merchant Marine.
Well, I was
detailed
with the
Navy and the Merchant Marine.
I was in the European theater.
Right.
So I had quite an experience. In fact, I worked with it. I've got about 28 years now in the mental health.
Right.
And for one thing, you said about 20% that are mentally in regards to, I think you meant as hospitalizations.
No, not that.
I read in American, in Medical Journal, rather, where actually 90% of the American people are at some time or another mentally sick. That could take in quite a few things to place on it. What do you think, actually, as a future program on the medical, that is, the medicine therapy, shall we say, call it? Do you think that actually it's not a cure, it's a retarding part, is it not, or what?
Well, to answer, take up your question, first of all, the 90% figure is, I think, way off base.
I read that in the American Medical Journal.
Well, it's one that I even if it were in the journal, I would thoroughly disagree with it.
I suppose probably if you hit your finger with a hammer and exploded, that would put you in that category.
Yeah. Nope, it's much more like 20% of the population at some time or other probably needs
now,
some
help. Another thing
help.
I would like to ask you, don't you think...
Well, Mr. Hoffman, yes, if you'd be kind enough to let Dr. Klein respond to your question, okay?
Yes, sir.
Right. As far as the physical methods of treatment go, we're back to the same thing. It's a question of what is or what is not appropriate for a particular individual. Most psychiatric disorders, emotional disturbances these days can be treated without the person having to go into a hospital. And I think the trend is and should be for the family physician to continue to learn more about treatment of psychiatric disorders. Now that there are effective methods of treatment that he can use, he is the man who really ought to be handling the large majority of such patients. He does already, but he can do so much, much better now than he ever could before.
Your echelon of speaking, though, you are actually probably, shall we say, in the primary or secondary. I'm speaking more, my experience in the future years has been in the third category, should I say, after they're institutionalized.
So?
And the lady asked about group therapy. I think it's a wonderful thing. And I think actually we're using it on the John Doe Public today by these so-called phone calls that people will speak on radio or telephone where they won't speak in a group. But see, that is actually a type of group therapy, a big group. When they speak over the radio, they feel more free, see? And I've seen it in group therapy. It's wonderful. I've seen people that wouldn't talk at all, and they will respond in a group. And I think it's one of the most wonderful things that's being used. Another thing I think that's lacking, and that is the public's attention to the use of money, especially on federal grants. People do not really take the time to go to see what is going on, and that is a very important thing on a group therapy.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that the federal government, our own tax dollars through the intelligent congressional use of this has done more to advance the not only psychiatry but medicine in general than anywhere else in the world. I think this is one of our great achievements that within the past 15, 20 years that the National Institutes of Health have really come from non-existence to being the center of world medicine, and this was done, I couldn't agree with you more, through support of mental health and other medical research. And one of the things that these days is a real problem is the fact that there's an attempt to cut back on spending for health favor of such things as armaments. Not that they're not necessary, but there are things, $4 billion a year goes for building roads.
Dr. Klein, I'm going to ask you to hold. We have to break for station identification. Mr. Hoffman, thank you so much for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
This is Night Call in New York. We'll return with our guest, Dr. Nathan Klein, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest, Dr. Nathan Klein, after station identification. Listen to the voices of Night Call.
Large numbers of black people in this country are coming to the point where almost no action, violent or nonviolent, legal or illegal, is looked upon as being the sort of action that will help. And I think that's a dangerous point for us, where we reach the point where nothing is likely to help us. And it means, I think, almost the beginning of suicide.
Julian Bond, a black politician, is pessimistic. And a white ethics professor has faith.
I don't agree. We're all upset. In spite of the many faults of the white people, I think there's a strong reservoir of compassion in a lot of white people in this country and a strong desire to see that the black man does get his right.
These voices, plus your own voice of question or comment, are Night Call. Speak for yourself. Speak for yourself from anywhere in North America to guest psychiatric researcher Dr. Nathan Kline about new forms of psychiatric medicine. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on 212-749-3311. From the West, 212-749-4300. And from the New York area, 866-5010. Again, Dal Shields.
From Utica, New York, Mr. Kappel is hearing Night Call over WRUN. Mr. Kappel?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Hello. I have, well, possibly two or three questions that may be tangential, but I think relevant.
I'll try two.
The first question is, very often in entering, these are pertain to state mental hospitals. And entering a state hospital, they try to impress you with the fact that there is no stigma attached to having been in a state hospital. Yet the very first thing they might do is ask for your driver's license so that the license bureau is immediately notified that you have been a patient of a state hospital. You take out a job application, and on there, the very question is, have you been a patient in a mental hospital? So, therefore, although they say there is no stigma, don't you think there is a stigma which would discourage a person to voluntarily enter a state hospital? Secondly, I wondered what you thought of the quality of employees in state hospitals. I've become acquainted with one where I thought the employees possibly did far more harm than good. I saw evidences of sadism. I saw where they could arouse paranoid tendencies in patients who perhaps never had them before because of their attitude. I saw attendants and employees actually gang up against patients who rebelled against the kind of treatment they got. I saw this happen with one patient in a remotivation class where he complained of certain practices, and then the attitude of all the employees immediately changed toward him and became very antagonistic. As a matter of fact, he was invited to on a sub-zero night when he complained of the temperature and the foul air in one room where all many of the patients were supposedly watching television, and the temperature was up close to 90 degrees. He was invited to go out on an open porch and cool himself off there. Such things as that. And then, of course...
Now, Mr. Kappel, what is your question, sir?
Now, the point is, do state hospitals do good, or would you encourage a person to voluntarily enter a state hospital under such conditions?
Well, let me go back and answer your first question. Of course, there's still a stigma attached to being in a state hospital. One of the things, again, one of the purposes in discussing this sort of problem and the very fact that we're doing so helps to remove some of the stigma attached to it. I'm afraid, like a lot of prejudices which we all have, that the best that we can do who have been brought up with such prejudices is to recognize them for what they are and to take them into account and act otherwise. I think that the trend toward community hospitals, getting away from the pattern of the old state hospital type system, is deliberately aimed at trying to make treatment part of the community, just as treatment of other medical disorders is. And again, as I say, my own personal emphasis is on trying to keep people, treat them so they don't have to go into a hospital, even more so than getting them out quickly. But at the present time, of course, there's a stigma involved, and I think that there have to be further changes made. As far as the abuses which you describe, I am certain that there isn't a system in the world of any type in which there are not some kinds of abuses. The way around it, of course, the way to overcome it, is to provide better salaries, better working conditions, and make the job more attractive. If someone can do something to help another person, there are very few people who deliberately go out to destroy. The problem is when they there are not adequate treatment methods, then there's a tendency, certainly, to, if you can't act intelligently, to act unintelligently. So what is needed is support of psychiatric facilities. And as our research progresses, we develop more and better methods of treating people. So certainly, I think the great stress in psychiatry should be on developing improved methods of treatment, which would include not only drugs, but everything from behavior therapy to helping halfway houses, helping people adjust in the community, so that if we want to get rid of this kind of both the stigma and the unfortunate conditions, what we should do is to lend whatever support we can. And when the congressman comes around, or someone runs for mayor or selectman or something else, to if you have an interest in the problem, to find out what their attitude is and what they're doing about trying to help people in this sort of condition.
Dr. Klein, even if we can assume that the treatment offered by state hospitals are adequate or more than adequate, are we not influenced by the many stories that come out constantly that the hospitals are tremendously understaffed and facilities are below what are actually needed in order to give adequate care?
Oh, of course we are, and to some degree it would be nonsensical to say that the hospitals have everything they need and they're perfect institutions. They certainly are not. They're incredibly improved over when I first started a quarter of a century ago. I think that there's still a great room for improvement, but there are programs such as the one in New York State that aims at creating hospitals within the community itself with a high level support and care and intelligent interest on the part of the community, so that people don't feel that it's someone else's responsibility, but to keep patients close to where they are, so that the stories, of course, are make great stories, just as people can pick other areas. But I think anyone who is really concerned, or at this point in time, most of the hospitals are delighted to have visitors who are interested enough to come and see what's going on, and even have people in the community volunteer to help out. We're glad for all the help that we can get.
Mr. Capel, thank you so much for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Dr. Klein, we have just about 30 seconds. I'm wondering if you could give us a kind of an abbreviated answer of, do we expect too much from psychology or from psychiatry?
No, I think the greater the expectations, the more performance those of us in the field are called upon to give, which is a good thing. I think if it's backed up by support, both in the form of donations to local mental hygiene societies, support of legislation, and this is really a tremendously important part of the state government, at the
Dr.
county.
Dr. Klein, I'm sorry, but time has run out on this. Thank you so much.
Give me a chance anyhow to make a couple of points which I consider important.
All right, thank you for being our guest tonight on Night Call.
Thank you very much.
This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Prescription prices for sugar pills is the high price of effective but chemically inexpensive medicines caused by research that produced them or by excessive drug company profits. How well is the Food and Drug Administration protecting the consumer? Is the drug industry taking you for a ride with Donald Gray? Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.